In a speech he delivered in Turkey 3 years ago, President Obama said that the United States isn't a Christian nation or a Jewish nation or a Muslim nation. We consider ourselves a nation of citizens who are bound by ideals and a set of values. To many Americans, our country is religiously neutral, and they point to the wall our forefathers constructed to separate church from the state as proof. But my next guest believes that that wall may be eroding, if it was intended to even be there in the first place. In his latest book, How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom, he argues about the most effective ways to frame this debate. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm very pleased it has brought Jacques Berliner-Blau, who is a professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're calling this book A Call to Arms, and your intended audience is obviously people who might become secularists.
Right. It's those who are secularists who are kind of in the doldrums right now. And it's also those who might be persuaded to come aboard. Absolutely.
And why a call to arms now? Haven't we the courts continuously observe the idea of separation of church and state?
Actually, no. It's not widely known that separationism as a doctrine, as a legal doctrine, is, I don't want to say it's dead. It's just kind of been tamped down for the last couple of decades, in particular since a 1985 decision, Wallace v. Jaffrey. And what's funny is everyone thinks it's there and alive and in great shape, and it's actually not.
Well, what about the claim that the phrase separation of church and state is in the Constitution and the First Amendment? Is it?
You show me where it is in the Constitution. Prolonged silence. No, it's not in there. And this is what conservative Christians have very cleverly pointed out. Where we first do see it is in Mr. Jefferson's 1802 Danbury letter to the Danbury Baptists. Hey, that's just a letter. What standing does that have?
And that was 1802. That was long after the Constitution was ratified. Mm-hmm. So what does the Establishment Clause of the Bill of Rights actually say?
Well, it says a whole bunch of really confusing things. And I started off as a biblical scholar, and I'm not one for the truth of original meanings and being able to pull out an original meaning from an ancient text. But I think, you know, look, we've got the Establishment Clause, right? And we've got the Free Exercise Clause, and we don't know whether we read them as a unity. Are they in opposition to one another? My personal view is Mr. Madison didn't even want to write them in the first place. I mean, that we know for a fact. In my book, I refer to them as a blunderbuss of a foundational premise for American secularism.
Isn't there a debate over whether Madison or Jefferson were even religious people? I've often heard they were deists.
They probably were deists. They're kind of inscrutable, and you could stick in George Washington into that cohort. What I think is important is that both really did want to maintain that strict, what we now call separation between church and state. Though Mr. Madison used the term lines, which I think is interesting, not a wall. They'd be lines. They were weird, Leonard. They were outliers, as I call them in my text. And I'm thankful that we had these outliers. But what I'm starting to realize is they may have been charging way ahead of that pack of founders in terms of their understanding of how religion and government should interact.
Well, many people claim that this country is largely founded on Protestant values. But then we get into the whole matter of what are Protestant values and which ones are we talking about?
No, it's unambiguous that this is a Protestant country in the sense that, yeah, we were founded on Protestant values. Hey, here's something interesting. Secularism, if you trace its genome, and what I try to do in the book is sequence the genome of secularism, all the great figures in the history of secularism, Martin Luther, Roger Williams, Locke, they're all Protestants. So smuggled into that is a lot of Protestant assumptions about the world and a little whiff, more than a whiff, of anti-Catholicism.
Because, Catholicism has changed in its place in America. There was an op-ed piece in the New York Times recently that pointed out that the same sorts of things we're hearing about Muslims today is what we heard about Catholics 30, 40 years ago.
Absolutely, and in particular in the 19th century. I think we've drowned down. I think American Catholics don't even like to call attention to how bad it was for them as a religious minority in the 19th century, which is a great argument for secularism. But as I point out, Catholics ran afoul of secularism in the 19th century because who were the secularists? They were nativists. They were xenophobes. They didn't like Catholics. As a result, they endorsed this idea of separation of church and state, which was almost singularly directed at Catholics who were simply trying to keep the schools neutral.
Because when Al Smith ran for president, later JFK, the critics said, well, they were going to take their orders from the Pope.
Dual loyalties.
And, and we had to keep a separation between church and state. Yesterday in the New York Times, there was a letter to the editor, which a minister suggested that it ought to be a policy in this nation that every high school student take a course in comparative religion. Does the federal government have the power to put a policy like that into action?
Yeah, it does. That's where separationism has moved. I alluded earlier to the fact that we really don't do separationism anymore. What we do is accommodationism. Accommodationism has been embraced by the Democrats, and it's the idea that a government can, in fact, interface with religion as long as it treats all religions equally. In theory, it's kind of pretty because there's no establishment. In practice, it's very, very complicated, and we can drill down now if you want, Leonard, and talk about the problem in the schools.
Well, first I want to talk about just what secularism means, point out that my guest is Jacques Berlin-Blau. His book, How to Be Secular, Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. Many people equate secularism with agnosticism and atheism, and secular humanism has come to represent those ideas. You make distinctions here?
Yeah, a noble mistake, but a mistake nonetheless. Secularism is actually born of Christian political philosophy, and it's a sort of two millennia running dialogue on the proper relation between the civil and the ecclesiastical authority. It has absolutely nothing to do with non-belief. Atheism is an anti-metaphysical doctrine. Now, the name of the book is...
But atheists would also want secular.
Absolutely, right. So the book is A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. I urged my editor to include a call to arms also for freedom from religion, but you can see how long that is. That's also part of secularism, and this is why atheism and secularism have locked arms historically for very, very good pragmatic reasons. They have common goals, but they're not the same thing.
And you place a great deal of importance on religious moderates. Why are they so important in the cause of promoting secularism?
Possibly because the discourse about religion in public space in the United States has been dominated by two extremes. On the one hand, the Christian right, and on the other, what we would call extreme atheists or new atheists. So I feel that there's a huge middle in between those two poles, and that's where the conversation should be occurring.
But these new atheists, these extreme atheists, as you describe them, they have very little power in this country.
They have very little power, right. Yes, I would concur. In fact, I think they have no power in this country.
Whereas the evangelicals have a lot of political clout right now.
Absolutely. The one difficulty is that the new atheists have come to speak on behalf of secularism, right? Whereas, well, what's the problem there? They're extraordinarily unpopular, and when they criticize religion, they throw the baby out with the bathwater, and they criticize the religious moderates as well.
Now, is this anything new? I remember Madeleine Murray O'Hare being pretty much called an embassy of the devil, right, when she was alive.
The most hated woman in America, as Life magazine referred to her. It's not new. There is a tendency in American atheist discourse to go strong, possibly and probably because of the somewhat suffocating and stultifying, overarching religious worldview in this country. So when atheists get angry in the United States, they get very, very angry. Whether that pragmatically helps the cause publicly is a question we have in Washington, D.C.
A listener has written in to ask you about the Treaty of Tripoli in 1797 that says that the government of the United States is no way founded on any religion.
Yeah, it's a curious document. That's Article 11 of the Treaty of Tripoli. Of course, we don't have the translation in Arabic, and Joel Barlow translated. Okay, long story short, when we get into these scrums about the proper place of religion in American public life, everyone goes back to the founders. So it's like a gunfight at the OK Corral, right? So the secularists, the non-believers, and the religious moderates crack out the Danbury letter, and they crack out the Treaty of Tripoli. That's generally what they have, and maybe Madison's detached memorandum. What I realized in the book was the opponents of that worldview could probably crack out a nuclear arsenal's worth of opposing documents where founders speak about the glory of the Christian religion, the necessity of predicating the Republic on Christianity.
But they didn't want an established religion here. And it's interesting when you look at Europe, where almost all the countries had established religions, how they have become a lot more secular than the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't that odd? You're speaking in particular of Anglican Britain, I would take it,
and
or Finland,
France,
perhaps.
And Scandinavia.
France is different. France is a noble experiment in laïcité. That's their version of secularism. And I defend the French because I know in the United States we chide them for not permitting religious freedom. But they have a very, very different history. There's a reason why they want religion monitored and under control. And we, quite frankly, don't have those reasons in the United States. We've never had the St. Bartholomew's massacre or
the war between Protestants and Catholics, actually. Catholics massacring Protestants on the whole.
Right. We don't. We have a very serene religious childhood in the United States, and that reflects itself in our founding documents.
But we're still suspicious of other religions. And Mitt Romney right now has to overcome suspicion of Mormonism. Although no one would suggest that it would affect the way he approached his presidency.
John Locke got it right in 1689. Everyone is orthodox to himself. Right? Everyone believes their way of revering or not revering the divine is the right way. And God bless them all. But the state's job is not to listen to them.
But you say that we shouldn't really equate secularism with the total separation of church and state.
Yeah, it's an impossibility. And this is one of the big problems in terms of secular activism, that when secularists enter the realm of disputation, they say, we want total separation of church and state. The problem is it's never been achieved. It's probably unachievable. And even the great friends of secularism, Supreme Court justices, have argued, well, we'll never have total separation of church and state. As Justice Douglas once pointed out. So if there's a fire at a church, does that mean that the municipal fire department can't put out the blaze because that's a religious institution?
But we've seen changes over the years. There was a time when the Scopes trial would have been looked on very differently than in the years that followed, when Inherit the Wind became a play. Scopes was the hero, and Clarence Darrow was the hero. In more recent times, we've seen a change again. Is this a reaction to the 60s or something else?
Yeah, the way I scoped it out, I do think the 60s...
Scoped it out?
Scoped it out, right. Can we use that? I think the 60s were really the moment when conservative Christians got back in the game. And we saw them after the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision re-enter American politics.
And then we have these two different sides making claims. Bill Maher says that the world is becoming more averse to religion. And then we have Pastor Rick Warren claiming that the world is becoming more religious. Right. Are they both right?
They're both wrong. They're both oversimplifying the equation to the degree to which it becomes very difficult to speak about religion publicly.
But you also trace the arguments for secularism back to Martin Luther, a very religious man.
A religious zealot, in fact.
So why would he want to have a separation of church and state?
Well, as I noted earlier, secularism has this Christian political DNA. And if you read the New Testament, if you read Augustine, there's this real concern about the two spheres on earth. And one sphere is the kingdom of God, and one sphere is the earthly sphere. And what Christians do is they ask themselves, how ought these two spheres interact with one another? So secularism is born of that initial question. Obviously, it develops and evolves in all sorts of different directions. But we have to tip our hat to Protestants for bringing this to us.
It is interesting that the Supreme Court has no Protestants on it,
the
current Supreme Court. Yeah. Catholics and Jews. And I would assume that if people were to look at the court, they might say, well, the Jewish members are mostly separationists, secularists, and the Catholics, to a large degree, not perhaps 100%, would be less so.
It makes sense. I mean, there was a great generation of Jewish separationists at mid-century who had a lot to do with bringing into being the new separationist order from 1947 forward.
On the other hand, right now, if you go to a place like Williamsburg, Brooklyn, I doubt that too many of the people living there are separationists.
Right. What they really want in terms of the ultra-Orthodox, I believe you're referring
South
to.
Brooklyn.
The Satmars, right. What the ultra-Orthodox want is they want federal funding for their schools, right? So this is a complete reversal of the classic liberal secular Jewish position of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where Jews are prominently represented in teachers' unions, for example. And the last thing they want, right, is more religion in schools. And prayer at the beginning of class time. So everything has flipped around, and these are demographics, I think, and these are facts that point to a massive, almost global shift, which I refer to as the revival.
You describe a number of cases where it seems as if states or even the federal government are poking holes in the wall between church and state. What was significant about the changes the Texas Board of Ed made in its social studies and history curriculum just a couple of years ago?
Yeah, what they did is they moved Mr. Jefferson out of one of the modules, not out of all of the modules. And the sense was that for many conservative Christians, Thomas Jefferson, as he was back when he ran for president right at the beginning of the 19th century, Thomas Jefferson is a dangerous, immoral infidel, and one must be very, very cautious. And now remember, he's the one who recoins the phrase separation of church and state, which he probably took from Roger Williams. So it did seem like they wanted to expurgate Mr. Jefferson from the curriculum.
Well, Jefferson was a complicated figure,
really was.
An owner of slaves, mm-hmm. and a man who both said wonderful things and did awful things. Is that the problem, that the founding fathers were a little more complicated than we would have liked?
Yeah, this goes back to your remark about Maher and Warren. Unfortunately, the realities on the ground are extremely complex, and these were very complex individuals with a complicated worldview.
Jacques Berliner-Blau is professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and director of the Program for Jewish Civilization, author of 4 books. The most recent, the one we've been discussing, How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.